Thanks so much for joining us. The weather has certainly changed. Last time I spoke with Tom Schroyer, it was summer. Then Gopher football started, and we were on a hiatus for quite a period of time this autumn. Now the final football game of the season tonight at the Dome, Minnesota and Iowa. You're back in studio. Tom, great to see you.
It is so good to be back here with you and Dennis in the studio here for our program. Moss and Burnett joining, of course, partnering with WCCO Radio to bring our listeners Minnesota Law, which deals every week with important items of interest, we think, to listeners about legal matters. And today we're featuring Dave Beek, who was here last summer as well and is back for a return appearance. He was so well received, and his topic is so timely and interesting. We're going to deal with patent law today. Dave, thank you and welcome.
Thank you, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
Dave, for our listeners' benefit, is a patent lawyer. That means he's been admitted to practice before what I understand is still the only subspecialty bar authorized under American law, that is the patent bar.
Well, actually, admiralty law, too.
All right. So
but
one
we're
of
on
two.
Land.
All right. And you've been doing this now for 21 years.
Correct.
And you served as outside general counsel and also inside attorney to for patents to Cargill.
Correct.
And now you're working at Moss and Burnett, and we're just thrilled to have you with us, prosecuting patents and handling advice to clients around them, and also handling litigation concerning patents.
It's never a dull moment.
All right. So the topic today is patents under fire. Dave, I have a passing familiarity with patents, and I've come across a couple that I think are so bizarre. I wonder what in the world are they given patents for these ideas on? And one was a laser light beam that was billed as a way to exercise cats by moving the light beam around on a whiteboard or a blackboard so that the cat would become infatuated with it and jump up and down. And another one I know Steve would like, it's a patent for how to grip a putter when playing golf.
I need that.
All right. What gives with this kind of a patent, Dave?
Well, I'm not personally familiar with either of those patents, but they probably result from the mechanical process used by the patent office for evaluating and issuing patents. When you file an application, you have to describe your invention, and you have to then claim the boundaries of what you want the exclusive right to practice to be. And the patent examiner will then compare that against what we call prior art, which is basically everything that has previously been out there, whether it is other people's patents, whether it's journal literature articles, things that have been done commercially in the past, public knowledge. And my guess is that they looked at the prior art, whatever cats do, and they thought that it was sufficiently different from and represented an inventive step over what had been done that they issued that patent. You got to also remember that just because a patent issues doesn't mean that it's an automatic gold mine. The patent has to have some sort of resonance in the marketplace such that people are going to be willing to take out their wallets and pay for the product. And I know there's a lot of cat lovers out there, but I'm not real sold on the laser pointer to stimulate cats.
Well, and we'll come back to some of those ideas that you raised. But the point is that patents have come under fire here recently on the grounds that, as I understand it, they are have been allowed to be too overreaching, and they have some potentially anti-competitive and maybe even anti-social sorts of results and applications. And maybe you can tell our viewers just a little bit about what's going on in terms of recent court decisions.
Sure, Tom. I think the thing we have to always keep in mind is that the patent system really represents a delicate balance of competing societal values. On the one hand, we want free competition between companies and individuals out there. We want people who have the best products to be able to bring them to the marketplace to sell them to willing purchasers. At the same time, we want to reward people who are unusually innovative, come up with great discoveries and ideas for the next great product or process. And that's what the patent system is all about, is rewarding those individuals. And so, therefore, a patent is a very limited property right that gives an exclusive right for a period, 20 years, to sell that product or process In order to obtain the patent, you have to convince the patent office that it is sufficiently new over what has been previously done that you should get that property right. And you also have to provide a disclosure, a public disclosure of how your invention works so that once your 20-year patent term is over, other people can pick up, read the patent, and say, this is how I do it. Now, that's a balance. That represents a balance. And there is always going to be a lot of second-guessing by people in the marketplace, whether it's companies who don't like getting sued, whether it's universities who don't like to have hurdles put up for their free and unfettered research, never mind the fact that they also have been pretty good at extracting value with patents, whether it's commentators. There are going to be people who are second-guessing whether such and such patent really should have been issued. We have a special court that was created 25 years ago called the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals to handle all patent appeal cases to provide unifying law and also perhaps to counteract what had been a trend before that of courts never finding patents to be valid. Our own Court of Appeals here in Minnesota was known as the graveyard of patents because prior to 1983, they had never found a single patent to be valid since I think it was the 1920s. And the Federal Circuit has done a very, very good job over the last 25 years of creating a unified body of law and consequently bolstering the patent system, and some of us might also say consequently bolstering the economy. Now we're starting to see a swing back in that pendulum, whether it's coming from the courts, whether it's coming from the patent office itself and some of the rules changes that it's been making or proposing, I should say, and whether it's been coming from members of Congress who have better ideas for how patent law should read.
David Beek joining us, Patent Law Under Fire, recent changes in patent law. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. David, I guess my question is, at the top of the program, who are these people in the patent office that consider patent applications? They must have expertise in a wide-ranging area of topics. They must have engineering backgrounds, scientific backgrounds, to be able to research and take a look at these different applications.
That's correct, Steve. Patent examiners have a very, very tough job because unlike me, where I've got a real live, walking, talking inventor to talk to who can patiently explain his or her invention to me enough times so that I finally get it, the examiner is really limited to what's in front of him in the written patent application and then what is also in front of him in the way of these prior art patents, prior art literature articles, etc. And so these examiners tend to be highly skilled individuals who have chemistry, biotechnology, science-type backgrounds, or engineering-type backgrounds. They also are all assigned to a particular area of technology, and so they will examine applications within that area of technology, and consequently, they get a pretty good familiarity with what the prior art is that exists in that field of technology.
And I imagine it can be time-consuming. I can imagine that this process can take months or years.
Well, yes. I mean, one thing you got to remember is that, or you find out very quickly, is these examiners really have a big caseload. And so once you file the application, you will wait a while for the examiner to get to and pick up your application and take a look at it and create that first examination. And these time periods have been stretching. When I first started around 21 years ago, we could expect that first office action examination to occur within about 6 months after examination. Now it's running around 2 years for mechanical and chemical type inventions. For business method applications, which are a newer area of patent application, they're running about 3 to 4 years. Now, the good news is once that first examination takes place, things happen pretty fast after that.
Well, that is good news. So patience, in this case, is a premium. You have to have, I would assume, all your legwork done because once you finally get an examiner to look at this application, it better be correct and it better be thorough.
Well, That's correct. And that's why we do as much homework with the assistance of our inventors as we can up front, so that we prepare as strong of an application as possible, both in terms of describing the invention and how it solves the problem that the inventor tried to solve, but also distinguishing it from all of the prior art that's known to us in order to make the examiner's job easier to understand the context of our invention.
We are going to take a break. We'll come back, take calls as well. Tom Schroyer, our host. It's good to see Tom back in the studio. Dave Beek joining us from the Intellectual Property Practice Group at Moss & Barnett. It is Minnesota Law on a Saturday, each and every Saturday at noon, here on News Radio 830 WCCO. Welcome back, Minnesota Law, presented by Moss & Barnett. Dave Beek joining us from the Intellectual Property Practice Group at Moss & Barnett. The president of Moss & Barnett, Tom Schroyer, is the host on the program today. We are talking patent law under fire, recent changes in patent law. The phone number on the program, 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. We want to go to the phones right now. Dick in Shoreview, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Dick Ludwig. Yes, a question for Dave, if you will.
Sure.
Back in the 60s, I was at the University of Minnesota, and one of the classes I had there was, for lack of a better term, creative thinking. The project for the class, at the end of the class, you had to be able to come up with something that was virtually patentable. Long story short, I was working in a pool hall part-time going to school, and I always noticed that the gals in there could never stroke a pool cue as well as their boyfriends, so I made this adjustable shooting pool cue. And I even brought it to the shop and or to the store and had the gals try. Anyway, I applied for a patent on this thing, and they told me that it was too close to the simple plunger shooter on a pinball machine. Well, I never did accept that, and the teacher I had, he said, "You should follow that further. You've got a heck of a good idea there." But it was so costly what they wanted to do that at the time. Keep in mind, I'm a 20-some-year-old kid trying to go to school. Has anything changed? Do you have avenues that, you know, that are more cost-efficient for pursuing something like that when you don't agree with a negative patent application?
All right, Dick, thanks.
Yeah.
Well, Dick, did you actually file the application, or were you just dealing with an attorney who was advising you on whether or not?
I filed the application, and I want to say that it cost, $300-something back in the 60s. That's as far as I went with the thing, and I kept going through. I think I took it through, through two steps of it.
Okay. And unfortunately, applications cost a little more than $300 now. But, you know, it sounds like you filed the application and you had an examiner who was applying what we call analogous prior art, or at least in his mind it was analogous. He was looking to this other field, finding something that he thought was similar to your mechanism for your pool cue. And he was saying that this mythical person of ordinary skill in the art, which is the standard for applying prior art to determine whether an invention is obvious or not, that it would have been obvious to that person to use this related technology. And it sounds like you got as far as what's called a final rejection. And your options at that point, and I don't think the law has really changed in this respect that much in the last, 40 years we're talking, your option at that point would have been to file an appeal, and that would have then been heard higher up within the patent office, and you and your attorney would have been arguing that was non-analogous prior art. And that's something that we still see today. You'll get examiners who don't find anything in your area of technology, and they're a little frisky, and they go further afield. And, I've seen that a number of times. I think in many cases I've been able to convince the examiner that it really is non-analogous, that it really would have been unreasonable to expect that person of ordinary skill in the art to go to this other – area and find this, and that therefore it doesn't render the invention non-obvious. Now, I'm afraid there is no way you're going to be able to resurrect your application 35, 40 years later, but that's what certainly I would have tried to do back then.
And Dave, after that, they could always the inventor could always appeal to the federal court for a decision overturning the patent office even.
Right. You'd have to go through the patent office appeal first before you get to the federal court. And
sure.
Of course, Dick, unfortunately, that does cost money.
All right, Dick. Well, we appreciate your call, and we'll welcome more calls following a brief news and weather break. The number on the program, 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. We're talking patent law. David Beek joining us from Moss & Barnett. Our host, of course, Tom Schroyer. Here on Minnesota Law, presented by Moss & Barnett, available online at moss-barnett.com. Welcome back. Minnesota Law continues, presented by Moss & Barnett. Our host, Tom Schroyer. Our president at Moss & Barnett, Dave Beek, joining us from the Intellectual Property Practice Group. And our topic today, patent law under fire, recent changes in patent law. If you have a question about patent laws, maybe you have an idea. We don't necessarily want you to spill the beans here on the air, but if you have a question about patent law, you're welcome to give us a call on the program today. 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. We go to the phones, and Tim from Minnetonka, you're on the air. Hi, Tim.
Good afternoon. I have a new product design that I initiated about 2 years ago, and I have a provisional patent that I received January of this year, and my understanding is that it only has a one-year lifespan, and then I need to then apply for a regular patent, if you will. And my question is that I'm kind of shopping it around right now, and I don't really want to spend the money on the full patent. Can I do that a year from now, or is that something that I need to stay on track in order to be able to continue that process? And then I have another question after that, if I could.
Are you there? Okay, Tim, you're going to need to file your regular utility application within 1 year after you file your provisional application. If you don't do that, you're then going to lose your provisional application, and what you'll really lose is the filing date, what we call the priority filing date for your provisional application. So if I understand your question correctly, you can wait and not file your regular utility application by January of 2009.
Right.
And then file it later, but you would then not be able to claim priority back to January of 2008 for purposes of trying to predate any prior art.
Okay, and just as a rough idea, the full patent for a new product, what kind of dollar range are you talking about?
To prepare and file the application?
Yes.
Well, that's going to depend on the nature of your invention, how complicated it is, and it's also going to depend upon the nature of the prior art, how much prior art you have to explain your way around. For a mechanical invention, typically to write a good application, you're probably looking at somewhere in the order of $10,000, $12,000. If you got a biotech invention, those can be more expensive because they're much, much longer applications to deal with gene sequences, et cetera.
Dave, we're talking this afternoon about patents under fire. And in that regard, we've talked a little bit about, with some level of brevity and humor, how some of the patents seem to be a little far-fetched. But you've had occasion recently, and I know over your entire career, but more recently, to work on a patent of great social utility, haven't you?
Yes. Well, many times over, of course. But one in particular, we've got a client who has developed some technology that is really very timely because it allows for much, much more efficient burning of coal so that it can be used by utilities and other companies that use coal in order to develop energy. And also what's really significant is it allows a lot of the contaminants in coal, whether it's sulfur, mercury, et cetera, to be reduced. So since environmentalism environmental remediation is a very, very timely topic these days. This is an invention that really rings two bells on that account.
And so we know from that and others that you've worked on and of course, that we see in our daily lives that patents can be a very good thing by stimulating inventors to come forward with their ideas and to commercialize them. On the other hand, there's been a number of different kinds of criticisms leveled at patents in recent years. In my view, many of those arise from what's called a business method patent that's been granted as a result of people really taking in my judgment anyway, prior existing business methods and running them through a computer or onto the internet and getting an invention claimed on those and a patent issued. And I know that there's been a lot of ferment in this area lately and some court cases.
That's right, Tom. And really probably the two things that have garnered the most criticism, one is business methods because certainly there are people who are not fans of business methods, methods of doing business being subject matter for patent protection. There's also what are pejoratively called trolls, patent trolls. These are companies that buy up patent rights or provide financing to inventors so that they can enforce their patents, basically money people who are coming in and providing money to inventors both so that they can patent and so they can enforce their patents. And, of course, if you are the company on the receiving end of that lawsuit, you're not feeling real kindly to that troll, as you call them. And so we've got a couple cases that have occurred in the last year or two that really do threaten to shake things up. The first is a Supreme Court case from last year called KSR, which directly addressed this issue of how you apply and analyze prior art when determining whether or not an invention is obvious or not.
Dave, maybe we ought to explain briefly what is prior art for our listeners.
Sure. Prior art is everything that came before in terms of knowledge that's relevant to the invention. So most typically it's thought of as patents. It could be patents owned by third parties. It could be prior published patents owned by the inventor himself. It could be scholarly journal articles. That's very, very relevant for areas like biotech, for instance. It could be prior industry usages. It could be other knowledge that was just publicly known within the arena. This is all collectively called prior art. And the patent office during the patent process and then courts later on during litigation are all going to be very, very interested in determining what is that body of prior art, how close is it to the invention in question, and is that difference such that the invention made an additional leap of innovation, if you will, such that it should be worthy of patent protection. And the problem with this inquiry, and this has always been a problem, is that we really are a people-based business, and so hindsight comes in. You know, if I have the ability to look at your patent application with your great description of your invention and how it works, well, everything seems obvious because you've taught me how it works. And so the law says that I need to go back to the point in time that the invention was made to make that inquiry. And then I'm not allowed to use hindsight.
So, for example, if we were talking about somebody inventing the wheel today and we were looking back and saying, boy, that's such a great idea, that's such a no-brainer, anybody could have thought of that, what you're saying is we can't apply hindsight to making that test of whether that idea was new and novel and thus capable of being protected by a patent. We have to go back and look at what the caveman thought when he figured it out in the first place.
That's right. That's right. And you know, this is not always the easiest thing to do because even I'm subject to exercising hindsight from time to time. And so that appeals court I mentioned before, the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, created a doctrine called teaching suggestion motivation that had been used for the last 25 years. And it said that you had to find in one prior art reference a disclosure of some sort of teaching or suggestion that would motivate this person of ordinary skill in the art to take that piece of that prior art disclosure and combine it then with another piece of another prior art disclosure to collectively, in combination, come up with what the patent application is saying its invention is.
And that was the test up until recently.
And that was the test until the Supreme Court in KSR said that is a useful test and it can be used in some circumstances, but we think, Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, you applied it too rigidly, that you are not giving this person of ordinary skill in the art sufficient credit for being a creatively minded person is the way they put it. And so, therefore, there needs to be a broader, more flexible inquiry.
So as a result of all of this, the Supreme Court made it harder to get a patent or harder to sustain it if it's been challenged?
Well, they may have. What they told us was they weren't going to provide us any specific test that we would have to wait for future cases to receive that, and so we're all waiting. And so what has happened in the meantime is patent examiners have probably been a little more emboldened in terms of striking down application claims at the patent office for being obvious. I'm seeing in the last year or two more examiners just sort of stating these broad conclusions of obviousness. Now, when I then challenge them in their position and say, well, you know, let's really look at your prior art reference that you're using and where is it, I am having some success in getting them to climb down from their position. But there's no question, in light of KSR, that it's making our job a little more difficult.
Our phone number on the program, 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. If you have a question for David Beek, our guest from the Intellectual Property Practice Group at Moss and Barnett, by all means give us a call. Patent Law Under Fire, recent changes in patent law. This is something that came up the last time you stopped by the program, David, and I think it is great. Is it doesn't necessarily have to be a new idea, something from the ground up new. It could be an improvement to a current product out there, but you have to be careful because maybe the manufacturer of that product may not want to hear from you directly. They may want to turn their back. They may not want to hear from someone outside in a way to improve their product. They may or may not.
Well, that's correct, Steve. You know, there's a lot of companies out there who have R&D engineering departments,
sure.
And unfortunately they think that all good ideas necessarily come within their department. And of course, I can tell you that that's not always true because I deal with a lot of small inventors who have great ideas. And that's why the patent system is really, really important and beneficial for those small inventors, because when they go to that company to show them their idea, and of course I hope they're all using confidentiality agreements, by filing a patent application that provides them an additional safety net to know that that company is not going to be able to say, I don't think your idea is great, and then go and run with it. And then the small guy finds out 2 years later when it comes on the market, marketed by that company, that, hey, that's my idea. But also, I think in my experience, it makes the companies a little more serious about reacting to the idea if they know that this small inventor did his homework enough to file a patent application.
We need to take a break on the program. We have a couple of calls lined up. We have Charles in St. Paul and Shane in Vadnais Heights. Once again, we're talking patent law under fire, recent changes in patent law. Dave Beek joining us from the Intellectual Property Practice Group at Moss and Barnett. Tom Schroyer, of course, our host of the program. We'll be right back. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, here on News Radio 830 WCCO. Minnesota Law continues, presented by Moss and Barnett, each and every Saturday at noon. Next week we'll be on at 11:30. Dave Beek from the Intellectual Property Practice Group at Moss and Barnett joining us. We're talking about patent law under fire, recent changes in patent law. Tom Schroyer, our host on the program today. Let's start with Shane in Vadnais Heights. Shane, you're on the air. Hello.
How's it going, guys?
Hi, Shane.
Hi. I'm employed by a local city as a mechanic, and I built a device for the installation and removal of snowplow equipment. Now, it makes it a lot easier, and it's something we needed. The reason I'm calling is because if I wanted to patent this device, I was wondering if it would create any legal implications, being that I was employed by them when I created it.
Do they listen to this radio program?
I don't know.
In all seriousness, Shane, you know, every situation is a little differently. I think you might need to go back to see if you sign any kind of employment contract or other agreement that expressly caused you to sign your invention rights over to your former city employer.
Okay.
Under the law, also in most states, including Minnesota, if you use company time or materials or confidential information to develop an invention, the employer is going to tend to own those invention rights. And in this particular area, my guess is that this would be right in an area of interest of them providing snow plowing services. And they would say that if your invention makes it easier to put on and take off big plow blades from the front of those trucks, that that's something that would definitely be in their area of business, so to speak. You need to look at the particular facts, but my guess is you're probably climbing uphill with lots of buckets of water on this one.
All right, Shane, we appreciate the call. Very good question. We'll go to Charles next. Charles, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, this is Charles. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. In August, I found a very unique product in China, interesting and innovative. They filed a patent, Chinese patent, August 2008. How do we... can we apply a U.S. patent within a year or so? And the second question is, how can we show it to the people, the product?
Good questions, Charles. If they've already filed an application in China, then because China has signed what's called the Paris Convention Treaty, they're going to be able to file an application in the United States before August of 2009, so within 1 year, and receive the benefit as if they had filed in the U.S. back in August of 2008. And so that's that priority claim that I discussed earlier in the hour with another caller. So it would be very important for them to file in the U.S. within that one-year period. Now, because they already have an application on file in China, they're going to safely be able to disclose anything that was disclosed in that application, because they'll receive the benefit of that information that's already in the application back to August of 2008, which would predate the new disclosures, which it sounds like you're asking about. The thing they've got to be very careful about, or you need to be very careful about if you're working with them, is not to disclose new information that was not in that application, because that information would not be subject to the priority date, if you will. And so you've always got this challenge with applications that you've got some information that may be in the application and other newly discovered information that's out. And so it's always good to try to file what we call a continuation in part application to add that new information to the application before you make a public disclosure, because that protects your rights not only in the United States but globally with respect to that new information.
Dave, that brings up a good point. You talked about the need to prepare a patent application very, very carefully. Here's the question. Isn't there a new case that just came out that talks about what it means to have an invention that qualifies for a patent, and doesn't that mean that you have to work even harder and be more clever about these applications?
That's right, Tom. There's a case called In re Bilski, which just issued in October. That deals with process inventions and says that for process inventions as opposed to products, compositions, matter, et cetera, that they either have to use a machine or they have to physically transform something. And that case is probably going to go up to the Supreme Court. We're all waiting for that. It could have the effect of making it more difficult, particularly to patent business method processes.
Our time has gone very quickly. We had a lot of great calls today. We appreciate that. Apologies to the calls we weren't able to get on the air. David, great to see you again. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks, Steve.
And Tom, great to see you.
Thanks. We'll be back next week with a really timely topic, talking about financial fraud and Ponzi schemes.
All right. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. We'll be on the air a little bit earlier next week. Our show begins at 11:30 next Saturday morning here on News Radio 830 WCCO.